Well, after reading the book of Judges, with its somewhat dark narratives and disappointing characters, we ended on a high note. We read the book of Ruth with its four chapters, much more uplifting and giving us a hope for what's to come. Ruth is the great-grandmother of David, and now we have the founding of the kingship. Earlier in the history of this Bible study, I want to say about 6 or 7 years ago, the Bible study read 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel. Maybe at some point we'll, you know, revisit those. But what we've done is now leapfrog over those histories. So 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1st Book of Kings, 2nd Book of Kings. And now we're coming to the history that really is related at the very end of the Book of Kings, as the kingdom of Judah comes to an end and the Jews are taken off into captivity. So to give you the historical background to the Book of Daniel, which takes place in Babylon during the Babylonian captivity. It just gives some background. If you look at the second book of Kings, it's in Kings 17 that we learn of the Assyrians taking away the 10 tribes to the north. So chapter 17, verse 21, when he had torn Israel from the house of David, they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord, made them commit great sin. The sons of Israel walked in all the sins which Jeroboam did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had spoken by all his servants the prophets. So Israel was exiled from their own land to Assyria until this day. So those 10 tribes of Israel vanished from the Holy Land, and by and large, they vanished from history. There's conjecture about where they ended up. Obviously, many of them simply would have just been resettled and intermarried with people in what would be modern-day Iran, Iraq, maybe eastern Turkey, among the group of people that we recognize as the Kurds. In fact, I think there is some genetic evidence that there's some of that is Hebrew, but by and large, in terms of identifiable tribes and identifiable groups of people, no, they vanished from history at this point. If you're at all familiar with Mormon belief, the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints teaches that these 10 tribes ended up in the United States. And they were killed by the Indians, who I think in the Book of Mormon are called Lamanites. And that's how it is that this new revelation comes to America, is from this lost 10 tribes. In any event, this land in northern, the land of Israel, the northern part, the northern kingdom, does not remain empty of real estate. You're told subsequently in verse 24 in chapter 17, the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, Savarvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the sons of Israel. They took possession of Samaria and dwelt in its cities. Okay. Well, now you have the background for why it is in the Gospels that there's such animosity between the Jews who live around Jerusalem, who live in Judah, versus Samaria. It's not just that these are people who are religiously different, they have their own center of worship on Mount Gerizim, but they are not ethnically related. They are outsiders. They are Gentiles. And this sort of casts a shadow over the rest of the north as well. So even when you have Hebrews who are living in places like Nazareth, they're still treated with suspicion in Jerusalem because basically everything north is thought of as impure, because the tribes that had possession of that land were moved out, and these enemy peoples were moved in. And even to the extent that you have people who are Hebrew, probably they're mixed in some way with these other people. So that's why they're treated with such, not just suspicion, but even animosity. Okay. As we continue to read in 2 Kings, we read of Jehoiakim, who he's the king of Judah, leads a rebellion. He's unsuccessful. He's hauled off. And at this point, Zedekiah reigns as king. So here we are in chapter 25. At the beginning of chapter 25, we're told, Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. Again, this is Nebuchadnezzar. In the ninth year of his reign, in the 10th month, on the 10th day of the month, the king of Babylon came with all his army against Jerusalem and laid siege to it. They built siege works against it round about. The city was besieged until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. On the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine was so severe in the city there was no food for the people of the land. Then a breach was made in the city. The king, all his men of war, fled by night by the way of the gate between the two walls by the king's garden, though the Chaldeans were all around the city. They went in the direction of Arabah. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king, overtook him on the plains of Jericho. All his army was scattered from him. Then they captured the king, brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah, who passed sentence upon him. They slew the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, put out the eyes of Zedekiah, bound him in fetters, and took him to Babylon. So this is how this king comes to his end. You have him see the most terrible thing that he could see, the slaughter of his own sons, and then you blind him. It's the last thing that he ever sees. And then he's hauled off as a captive. As we learn later, there are a number of captive kings in the Babylonian court. Jehoiakim is still there. And verse 8 in chapter 5, there we're told that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, begins transplanting people or marching people out of Jerusalem. The rest of the people who were left in the city, deserters who deserted the king of Babylon together with the rest of the multitude, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried into exile. You're told in verse 12, the captain of the guard left some of the poorest of the land to be vine dressers and plowmen. So please understand that when we talk about the Babylonian exile, we don't mean that every man, woman, and child was hauled off to Babylon. Rather, what happened is the notables, people who would have been what we would call the upper classes, maybe the middle classes, certainly the nobility, certainly citizens of influence, these are all people who are hauled off. And if you like, your lower classes, your kind of simple farmers, your manual laborers, these are the people who remain behind. Okay. Similarly, after the Babylonian exile is over, it's not like every man, woman, and child who is living in Babylon who is Jewish comes back. Some number of them remain in Babylon. So some number of those Jewish communities are still active and lively in the time of the Romans and then afterwards. A note, I've said this before, but it's helpful to remember. It's at this point in history that the Israelites or the Hebrews start to simply be called the Jews. Remember, there are 12 tribes. There are 10 tribes of Israel. There are 2 tribes of Judah. Well, because the 10 tribes all get hauled off, and only the kingdom of Judah remains, Judah and Benjamin, therefore those people tend simply to be called Jews. Okay? Sometimes there'll be a distinction between Jews and Israelites. You'll see that in the book of Daniel. You'll see it in the narrative of Susanna. But strictly speaking, all that's left of the 12 tribes of Israel are these two tribes of Judah, and so the people are simply called Jews. The other, before we leave the second book of Kings here, if you turn to the end of the chapter, you're given some hope. This King Jehoiakim, who is kept captive, verse 27, you're told that in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, in the 12th month, in the 27th day of the month, Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, in the year he began to reign, graciously freed Jehoiakim, king of Judah, from prison. He spoke kindly to him, gave him a seat above the seats of the kings who were in Babylon. Jehoiakim put off his prison garments, and every day of his life he dined regularly at the king's table. And for his allowance, a regular allowance was given him by the king every day, a portion as long as he lived. So the book ends hopefully that this king is being treated well, and it will be another several decades before the chosen people are allowed to go back. But the book doesn't want to leave you, as it were, bereft of hope. That kindness which comes from the king foreshadows, if you like, the kindness that they will eventually get once they are allowed to return. Pardon me. The other text I think is helpful to understand as you go into the book of Daniel is Ezekiel. Ezekiel is prophesying before the time of the Babylonian captivity. Indeed, he prophesies it. If you look at Ezekiel 12, this is the prophecy of the captivity. But before the captivity happens, in Ezekiel 10, this is where you have this famous a vision from Ezekiel of the wheel, many-faced, many-eyed, many-winged sort of creature coming out of the temple. And it becomes clear to Ezekiel as he has this vision that what he's seeing is the Shekinah, it's the glory of the Lord. So if you look at chapter 10, this is the whole description, verse 18, the glory of the Lord went forth from the threshold of the house, stood over the cherubim. The cherubim lifted up their wings, mounted up from the earth in my sight as they went forth, and the wheels beside them where they stood at the door of the east gate of the house of the Lord, and the glory of God of Israel was over them. Okay, so in a vision, Ezekiel is seeing the glory of the Lord leaving the temple. If you think back to the time in Exodus as they're leaving, as they're being led through the desert, the pillar of fire by night, the pillar of cloud by day, that they have the angel of the Lord with them, that they have the tabernacle, they have these very clear signs of God's presence with them. And that is made firm during the time of the kings by the building of the temple during the reign of Solomon. So that in the Holy of Holies, with the Ark of the Covenant, with the remnants of the manna, the rod of Aaron, and then the veil before the Holy of Holies, which the high priest is only able to enter once a year, they have these very clear signs of God's presence among them. But now their behavior is simply so bad. They've turned from God in ways that are simply so shameful and so wicked that God makes it clear that he's leaving the temple, that he is no longer present there. In Joshua Berman's book, The Temple, you know, he raises this problem, isn't it? You know, why is God simply going to leave his people in this way? Isn't it somehow almost disrespectful to his own agreement to be present among them that now he's going to leave the temple? And the response that he makes is that when their behavior is so bad, it's simply scandalous for him to remain present in his glory in the temple. That it appears as though God tolerates or somehow condones their bad behavior. Remember, they're at the point where they're actually worshiping other gods, sacrificing to other gods before the temple. Okay, so they want to have it both ways. They want to worship these pagan gods at the same time that they want to worship the true God. So in Ezekiel 10, you see that the glory of the Lord is leaving the temple. Now, all of this can help us understand to some degree how the book of Daniel came about in the background and some of the strange features of the book. One of the things that makes the book stand out is even though Daniel has, 13 or 14 chapters? Daniel has 14 chapters. There are three different languages in this book, so that most of the book, some of the book was Hebrew. I think most of it was Hebrew. There's a section in chapter 3, the Canticle of the Three Young Men, which was in Aramaic, and then the last two chapters of Susanna. And then chapter 14, the dragon, Bell and the Dragon, those chapters were in Greek. So when you look at the Septuagint, all 14 chapters were accepted as canonical, as part of the Hebrew Bible translated into Greek. At a later synod, after the time of Christianity, the standards are adjusted so that the books to be considered canonical have to originally have been in Hebrew, composed before a certain time, and then originally in Hebrew. So the Canticle of the Three Young Men gets dropped. These last chapters that were in Greek get dropped. If you pick up a Protestant Bible, this is one of the things that stands out to you, is that there are a number of these books from the Old Testament that are not in the Protestant Bible, and that was because Luther and other reformers accepted this later revision of the Old Testament as opposed to the form that the Old Testament had in the Septuagint, which was the standard for Christians, certainly throughout the early church. The reasoning behind that is, I've read it at one point, I just don't remember it anymore. I need to go back and revisit it. But in any event, so things like books such as Tobias, Wisdom, Ecclesiasticus, or Sirach, as it's sometimes called, and then these books, there are a couple of others, they end up getting considered apocrypha. And as we read the book of Daniel, especially these later chapters, I guess I want to argue that they really do merit being part of Scripture. The account of Susanna, for example, I think really does give us a very helpful image of the purified church. In John 6, with the woman taken in adultery, we have the church as it mostly looks on earth. In other words, that it's a church with sinners, and so a church in some way tainted with sin, but nonetheless a church that will be forgiven and healed. Susanna is the virtuous bride. She is really an example a figure for the purified church and the faithful church. So I think there are things that, in all the Apocrypha, that even if you wanted to deny that they were inspired, are nonetheless edifying and helpful. The book of Tobias, for example, I think some of the best material in terms of understanding the graces of marriage are there in Tobias. When St. Thomas is explaining the graces of matrimony, he illustrates them through using the book of Tobias, because it simply It simply does that so clearly. So this is a book that's written in exile, and perhaps bears the marks of that in some way, that it's a mixture of the language of the people of Hebrew, but also this language that's more commonly shared, Aramaic. And then these last two chapters, for whatever reason, come to us in Greek. Why that is unclear. I should say something about the canticle of the three young men. This is something that in the Catholic world, that canticle is part of morning prayer. In the days when prayer was divided, matins, lauds, prime, matins was said before dawn, lauds was usually said at dawn along with prime. The canticle of the three young men was something that was recited as part of that. So the canticle of the three young men is not part of the liturgy of the mass. It's not part of the part of worship, but it is certainly part of prayer that's used by religious orders, by the lay faithful who pray the prayers of the church. So that canticle of three young men, in other words, is a part of daily prayer in the Catholic world. So it's not a marginal piece as it stands in the book of Daniel. But again, we can talk about that when we get to chapter 3. The other thing to note at the front end about the book of Daniel is that it's the beginning of what we would describe as apocalyptic literature. Now, when you see that term apocalypse, for us, because the book of Revelation, also called the book of Apocalypse, concerns the end of the world, for us, apocalyptic means something that has to do with the end of the world. Apocalypse simply means the way it's translated in the New Testament, revelation, something that's revealed, something that is being made clear to you. And certainly there are moments in earlier prophets that are like what we see here in Daniel. There are, if you like, apocalyptic moments. But this is the piece of literature out of the Old Testament that really is first characteristically apocalyptic. And what do I mean by that? Consider the position of the Hebrew exiles. To be an observant Israelite meant that you were faithful to God and that He rewarded you with putting you in this land, that you were in this promised land, and that you had a king and that you would be free from enemies. If you disobeyed the covenant, then you would be punished by misfortune, maybe famine, maybe plague, maybe invaders, okay? Maybe a combination. But at the point where they've become so bad that they've simply been removed from the promised land, that they are now living in exile, for the Jews, for the Jewish people now, there's just this feeling of despair. What is our future? What does the future hold out for us now? There is no promised land. There is no temple, which is that visible sign of our connection to God. Where is this going? Again, what hope do we have? And apocalyptic literature speaks to that now new condition, because apocalyptic literature is not just giving you a prophecy. Okay, this is a difference between apocalyptic literature and just prophecy. Prophecy is first of all, making you aware of the state you're in and how God views it. Pardon me. That's how someone like John the Baptist, even though he is preaching about a future, the first thing he's doing, repent for the kingdom of God is at hand. He as a prophet, is making people aware of where they're at. Okay? But also, there is a prophecy of the future. But with apocalyptic literature, there's now a much bigger and grander picture. So it isn't just, this is what's going to happen, this is what's going to happen to you. This is God's plan. And God's plan in a kind of a cosmic way. It's as if you're seeing the supernatural machinery operating in the sky. Okay? And it's an elevated vision of God's providential plan. And so what that means is, unlike the prophet who tends to speak in his own name, who has a vision, now he brings it to you, in apocalyptic literature, usually what we see is the prophet is having some sort of special visitation that somebody, for example, what we're going to see here in Daniel is that the angel Gabriel and the angel Michael are going to appear to him and reveal things to him. Now he's going to share that with us. But he's not just going to say, this is what I saw. He's going to say, this is what I was told. Okay, this is what I was told by Gabriel. This is what I was told by Michael. And this is what you see, of course, in the book of Revelation in the New Testament, that John is given a vision of things, and he has these higher beings. He has angels who come and tell him things, who reveal things to him about the direction of history, the direction of where all this is going. Okay, that's something that's different with apocalyptic literature over just prophecy. Now, we're used to Gabriel and Michael in the New Testament. These are familiar figures for us. But if you go back, put yourself back in the mindset of Old Testament Revelation, now moving forward from the Pentateuch through the historical books, now into the prophetic books. You have not gotten the name of angels before. That you are getting revealed angelic names. That's new. And in fact, in general, when you look at the involvement of angels, think about like in Judges, where the angel appears to Samson's parents, Manoah and his wife, and prophesies to them about the child that's coming. They seem just like human beings. And it's not until later that you're aware that there was some kind of special visitation, that this was a spiritual or supernatural presence that was here. Okay? That doesn't clear immediately. So as you think about this encounter with Gabriel and Michael, we are getting more information now about the angels than we were before. So there as we get to those chapters, we'll see there's a kind of angelology, if you like. There's a kind of deeper information, deeper understanding that's being offered to you about these angelic beings. You get a better sense of how supernatural they are. And they come into the narrative as the means for Daniel having this, again, elevated picture of what's going to happen with the chosen people. Okay, we have to remember that once the exile is over, and they return to the promised land, they really have been purged of their idolatry. When they go back, they are no longer worshiping Baal or Ashtoreth or Moloch. They really have had that cleaned out. So that once the Messiah arrives, they will be in a position where they will really recognize him. It won't be like the pagans who Paul and Barnabas preach to when they see human beings do supernatural things and they think that Paul is Mercury and they think that Barnabas is Zeus. They will be able to understand that God really is above, really is this being above nature and above creation. But on the other hand, that somehow this man, Christ Jesus, is truly human. And yet joined to that divine nature. Okay? That they will really understand, or at least be able to grasp, the distinction between the infinitude of God and yet the reality of Christ as a human being, and be able to put that together. And more importantly, bring that to an unbelieving world. Bring that to an unbelieving world. So as we look at the book of Daniel, we want to recognize that this is an early form of something that we see full-fledged later on in things like the book of Revelation, the New Testament. That in this book, we're we're getting a with rich symbolism and a rich sense of mystery. Nonetheless, we are getting a picture of what the future is, and not just the future of what's going to happen to this people, but a more cosmic sense of sort of what's God's plan, not just for the Hebrew people, but plainly for these other nations in terms of how they fit into this plan. Well, that's probably enough for an introduction. Next time we'll talk about chapters 1 and 2, and you have your assignment for questions. We'll, for small groups in chapter 1, they'll be looking at questions 2 and 4 for understanding, and then the applied questions will be 1 and 4. And chapter 2, you'll be looking at questions 3 and 4 for understanding, and then questions 2 and 4 under application. Those other questions are good too. I just pick those because I think those are going to be closer to what we'll be focusing on in class. But, you know, if you have time, please feel free to look at the other questions. But that's the one we'll be focusing on for the class. Very good. See you next week.